from the hidden tomb of an ancient pharaoh to how a mummy might have smelt.
We've got answers to all things Egyptian in this episode of the Time Team Podcast.
Yes, hello, and welcome to the Time Team Podcast with Martin Williams and Helen Geek, where we have big news, Helen.
We do. Now, we know that you've been enjoying the podcast because you've been telling us on Patreon and on YouTube, and we love making it too. So, we've decided to take it up a notch to bring you more from the world of archaeology. From now on, we'll be bringing you new podcast episodes every Tuesday.
Every single Tuesday, yeah. And our extra episodes are going to give us the opportunity to get you answers to the questions that you've been sending in on Patreon, because we do try and get through as many of them as we can now, but we're going to be able to devote more time to it. So from now on, we are weekly.
And I am going to learn so much from the questions that you send in, because they really make me think. But let's not get ahead of ourselves, because there's plenty to come on this episode. We've got Naomi Supal demonstrating an archaeological technique called flotation. And Time Team's Lawrence Shaw will join us with news of a brand new Time Team YouTube video coming out on Saturday.
Yeah, all of that to look forward to. And of course, your Patreon questions in this episode as well. Now, there was a big old glitzy awards ceremony that happened the other week, Helen, wasn't there? The Current Archaeology Awards celebrate the work being done within the field right across the UK.
Yes, now they're sponsored by Current Archaeology magazine, and the big gong on the night is the Archaeologist of the Year Award. Here's the moment the winner was announced on stage.
The Archaeologist of the Year is Professor Joyce Tisley.
Big congratulations then to Joyce Tisley, OBE, Professor of Egyptology at the University of Manchester, and now Archaeologist of the Year. Joyce, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. I feel so honoured. I don't really know what to say. It's kind of overwhelming.
Well, I mean, what did that moment feel like when you were called up on stage in front of all those hundreds of people to accept the award?
To be honest, it was a bit surreal. I hadn't expected to win, so I was sitting right at the back. So I had to walk down what seemed like about 100 steps and then go up onto the stage with everybody looking at me. It's absolutely great to know that somebody's actually recognised the work that you're doing.
It was a very strong field, wasn't it, of the people nominated? So why do you think that you got the award?
I just can't say. I mean, I know Egyptology is always quite popular, and I'm also I've got an atypical background because it's voted for by the public, and maybe something in my background appealed to people. And I've also spent a lot of time working on trying to make the past, and particularly ancient Egypt, but more accessible to people. So maybe that's just something that appealed to the voting public. But honestly, I don't know.
Congratulations on the award. Very well deserved. We are now going to use you to, we'll pick your brains on everything that we want to know about ancient Egypt. And I thought we might start with a story that we actually featured on our Time Team News in our last episode about the discovery. And this is of maybe one, but possibly even two tombs, which belong to King Thutmose the second. I didn't think that there could be any more about ancient Egypt that you could discover at that site. I thought, well, surely that area has been combed to within an inch of its life for anything.
It's roughly the age of Tutankhamun. He's an ancestor of Tutankhamun. It's the 18th dynasty. So it's a long time ago. And we don't know where everyone was buried in particular, actually. I mean, we're sort of fairly okay on kings. We've got most of them. But there are lots of royal women missing. We don't have the queens and we don't have their families. And these kings were polygamous. They had many wives, many children. There must be an awful lot of royal or semi-royal burials still out there.
So there could be loads more. That is so exciting. If you want to be Indiana Jones or whatever, the thought that you could discover the next pharaoh's tomb or whatever it might be is so interesting.
The one thing I would say, though, these tombs near the Valley of the Kings, this isn't in the Valley of the Kings, which is where Tutankhamun is buried, but it's near enough to it. A lot of them from the New Kingdom, which is the period that we're talking about, at the end of the New Kingdom, they were emptied out. Egypt was in a bit of turmoil. They were under threat. The Nile was being unstable. The royal control had been lost. You know, the country was fragmenting slightly, as it does from time to time. And the priests who were in charge of the necropolis, the royal cemeteries, actually emptied out the royal tombs, which were being attacked by thieves, took away all the grave goods and repurposed them, recycled them. And you could look at that two ways. They were either saving them from the robbers, or they were actually just getting a big amount of loot into their own bank accounts, if you like. But they saved the bodies of the pharaohs, stripped them off, took away all their amulets and gold and so on, rewrapped them up again and stored them in the Valley of the Kings in various cache tombs. And we found quite a few of these. We actually have the body, and have had for a long time, the body that we think is Thutmosis II, for example. But this is a long-winded way of me saying that we have tombs missing, but we have the bodies, and we know that they were emptied out, a lot of them, at the end of the New Kingdom. So unless we find a tomb that was actually overlooked by the people who emptied out the royal tombs, it's unlikely that we'll find one that's intact.
So why was Tutankhamun's tomb intact?
I don't think he was buried in the tomb he was intended to be buried in, because his tomb is quite small. It's like a storage tomb, really, and it's in the bottom of the Valley of the Kings. And you wouldn't want to put your tomb there, because the Valley of the Kings, obviously it's very dry, but when it rains, it really, really rains, and the rain rushes down the mountainsides, and it brings down an awful lot of rubble. And this is what happened to Tutankhamun's tomb. It was covered with rubble, and it was lost sight of. I think the tomb he should have been buried in was a tomb that was taken by the king who followed him, King Ai. King Ai was an old man when he came to the throne, and it seems to me that he swapped them, that Tutankhamun would have built a much better, bigger tomb near his ancestors in the western valley of the Valley of the Kings, and that Ai would have been preparing his own when he was non-royal, his own in the floor of the Valley of the Kings. But of course, by swapping them, he saved Tutankhamun, because yes. Tutankhamun was buried in this cramped tomb, he was pushed in. And very soon after, he was covered in floodwater debris. And then after that, people building other tombs in the Valley of the Kings built their huts on top of his tomb. That's what saved him. And then, of course, when they were excavating in the Valley of the Kings, because it was on the valley floor, they didn't excavate there first. They looked higher up, because that's where they would have expected to find them. And it was the very last gasp of looking for someone that they looked there to find him. And I loved the idea that he was saved by someone who actually swapped tombs and tried to disadvantage him, but actually advantaged him hugely.
But here we are, of course, again, talking about kings and pharaohs and the top end of society. And we on Time Team like to say that the thing about archaeology is that it's not just about the people that make their way into the history books. It's about the people that don't. You look at everything, don't you, in your work? And what are you working on at the moment?
I'm writing a book. It's a women's view of Egyptian history. I'm taking real women who lived at different times in Egyptian history, and I'm looking at their lives, what we know about them. It's certainly not rewriting history from a female viewpoint, but what it is adding to the history we have and showing that these women, and I've tried to choose as many non-royal women as I can do, the vast, vast majority of people, and throughout Egypt's long dynastic history, the vast majority of people were not mummified, and they were buried in pit graves in the desert. But we can't say a great deal about them.
So what are we able to say then about the lives of ordinary people in ancient Egypt? Because I think I've always had this view in my mind that Egypt was such an almost futuristic civilization. You know, they were so advanced compared to what you might think that other civilizations were doing at the same time. And that might have been true for the people at the very top. But what about the people at the bottom? What sort of lives were they living?
A lot of people were what I guess we would loosely describe as peasants. They lived in hamlets. They worked the land. They used techniques that had been developed for many, many centuries. They used pretty much the techniques that their grandparents and their grandparents and so on would use, because the Egyptians don't really like to interfere too much. They're not very innovative. Once they've found the right way of doing something, they stick with it. It would be a fairly unchanging life. And I think it would be quite a hard life. I mean, one of the problems we have is that we look at the tomb walls and we see people having what look pretty idyllic lives. You know, they're wearing beautiful white clothing and jewels, and they might be in a field, but they're happily ploughing a field. What they're showing us on these tomb walls is not a snapshot of daily life at all. These are elite people, and they're depicting on the walls what they hope will happen in their afterlife. So it's completely idealized. I think for most people, it would be quite a short life. It would be a hard-working life. Women, for example, probably had to do an awful lot of textile production because linen, flax, was grown and was the main textile in ancient Egypt. But if you think about it, there's such a demand for linen in Egypt because of the mummification process. There'd be an awful lot of housework for women and that sort of thing. I don't think we assume that they're just all sitting at home doing nothing.
Yeah, so they've got to make clothes for the dead as well as clothes for the living.
Clothes for the dead, bandages for the dead. If you had a family that was sort of what we might call middle class, that was having the dead mummified but wasn't particularly wealthy, and, I don't know, an attack of even diarrhoea might wipe out three or four family members, and you would really be struggling to just acquire enough linen to actually mummify.
That amount of investment in the dead is extraordinary, isn't it? But I was taken with what you said about the Egyptians having a stable kind of society where there wasn't an awful lot of innovation. I'd like to know much more about transport and communications, because obviously you've got the Nile linking it all together. But what did that mean day to day? How much traffic was going up and down? How was this enormously long country being unified? I can't even imagine really how you can unify Anglo-Saxon kingdoms into England. I think, well, gosh, marching up to Northumberland takes me quite a long time to drive, let alone get there with a on foot and horse with a baggage train. I find this really tantalising, how you practically unite a kingdom in the days before proper roads and proper communications.
Everything seems to depend on the Nile. If they didn't have the Nile, I mean, they wouldn't, for example, be able to transport big blocks of stone. So they wouldn't have been able to build the pyramids in the same way that they did. They wouldn't be able to transport grain. They wouldn't be able to raise obelisks, because obelisks get the hard stone from the south and transport in some cases right to the north. So that it's absolute key to everything, the Nile, and everyone uses it. If you're going to a building site, say, you will cut a canal to go from the Nile so that you can do as much by water as you possibly can. The question of unifying the land is really interesting, because they always regarded themselves as two lands, Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt, and the king wears two crowns of Upper and Lower Egypt. And every time there was a bit of a crisis, it would fall apart and the Upper and Lower Egypt would become the dominant things again. Kings regularly spend a lot of time going up and down the Nile, presumably to remind people that they're there. There's a constant awareness that you have to be seen. Religion, to an extent, will also slightly unite the country, but not to a great deal. It's always teetering on the brink of collapsing, but doesn't collapse.
And it's all politics as well, isn't it? Which we know quite a lot about as well. That's the age-old problems of how do you bring people with you and how do you rule them without them sort of overthrowing you and things like that. One more question, Joyce, just before we let you go, because this I read a few weeks ago now, and I thought, I need to ask you about it. There's been some research done into what Egyptian mummies smell like. Did you see any of this?
I have seen some of that, yeah. And I find it quite interesting, because I've worked in museums and I've been lucky enough to be in the room with mummies, and they do.
Give it a little sniff.
Well, you can't help it. There is a definite smell to them.
What's it like? Is it a perfume, or is it something horrible, or what?
No, it's not horrible at all. It's quite distinctive. It's sort of woody and a bit like tobacco, like dried out leaves, maybe, that sort of thing. Occasionally, if a mummy gets damp, then obviously it will start to rot. Then obviously the smell is very different. But a dried, perfectly preserved mummy does have a distinct smell. So, and it's really interesting, because one of the things that we would love to know more about, but it's very difficult, isn't it, is the smells of the past. If they could identify the smell of the mummy today and break down what's in it, they might also be able to identify what they smelt like when they were made.
The science of smells, I wonder where it could take us. Well, we'll leave you with that thought, Joyce, as well as us as we ponder it. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your vast and wide-ranging expertise on life in ancient Egypt. And once again, congratulations on being Archaeologist of the Year.
Oh, thank you so much, and thank you for inviting me. It's been wonderful.
This is the Time Team podcast, with answers to your Patreon questions coming up a little later. Now, there's a new episode of Time Team going up on YouTube on Saturday. You'll be able to watch part one of our brand new expedition crew videos. Lawrence, Derek, Naomi and Hilda head to rural Derbyshire to uncover a mysterious site.
Yeah, and I got a little preview, actually, of that video the other day, and I can safely say you won't be disappointed. Lawrence Shaw, who is part of our expedition crew, is here with everything you need to know. Hi, Lawrence.
Hello, guys. How you doing?
Very, very well, thank you.
Very well.
Can you explain what is the expedition crew?
It's a really exciting concept. So what we're doing, it's a discrete sort of structured team of four or five people that are going to sites that are in challenging areas that have really specific questions that don't need the full might of Time Team but can really benefit from Time Team looking at them. And we go in and we do a traditional three-day excavation, but we have really specific targeted questions. We don't have a digger, we just use our hands and we just use the bits that we can stick in the back of a camper van and produce some meaningful outputs.
Just use your hands. I hope you can take a spade with you.
A spade, pickaxe, mattock, even some geophysics if it can fit in the back of a camper van.
So you're not like moles, that's good to hear. So what have you been up to then? Come on.
Oh, I mean, this is a really exciting first expedition crew dig. So this is a site that was brought to my attention about 3 years ago by a local enthusiast. And it's the third largest standing stone in the Gritstone Moors in Derbyshire. And this chap, George, had suspected that it might be part of a larger monument. And we sort of looked at it and we thought about it. And what we've done is bring Hilda, Naomi, Derek and myself out to site with a bit of support from some volunteers in Sheffield University to answer his questions. Is this a single standing stone or is it part of a larger prehistoric ritual landscape, or was it only erected in the Victorian period?
Oh, is that an option? You mean it could be one of these things where people think, well, I'd like one of those monuments in my back garden. I haven't got one at the moment. I'll just put one up.
Yeah, it could be. That was one of the questions. The area was moorland that was used for agriculture, then it was planted for forestry. So is it sort of a boundary stone or a boundary marker that in more recent histories? And it's safe to say we got an answer.
Excellent.
Yeah, there is an answer. And I know you're not allowed to obviously tell us what that answer is because you've got to wait and you've got to watch on Saturday. But what can you say about some of the challenges that you faced whilst out on this expedition?
Yeah, well, I think the whole point of the expedition crew projects is that we're meant to go to challenging environments. We're meant to get to places where a discrete team can get to and we don't need to lug loads of equipment. So we have plenty of challenges from just getting to site to actually accommodation. You know, in some of these more remote locations, we don't have nice hotels down the road. So we're all sleeping in our camper vans. We're cooking our breakfasts. We're keeping warm in sleeping bags and getting fires going. But then also on site itself, there's a lot to dodge and avoid, not least Derek. I mean, he's always under our feet, but plenty to dodge and consider, from cut down trees and fallen trees to lumps and bumps and heather and brambles. And that also makes interpreting the archaeology a slightly more tricky as well. It's not a nice big open field with a big yellow digger trowel to open up some trenches for us.
It's a beautiful landscape as well, and some of the shots that you see in the film they just make you want to go and visit that location because it does just look beautiful, right by the River Derwent as well. It's a great film, Lawrence, and I know that the conclusion is particularly exciting and interesting. You can catch that expedition crew special on Saturday, as I said, over on YouTube. Straight after you've watched it, head to Patreon, because Lawrence, alongside Naomi Supor, who is another one of the people who's on that expedition, they're both going to be joining me for a full debrief of the episode. Behind the scenes stuff, loads of sort of extra in-depth information on what they discovered as part of that. Lawrence, thank you very much. Good luck with it.
Thank you.
Now, speaking of Naomi, she's a bit of an expert on a really useful technique called flotation, which you can see in action in the programme.
Yeah, and it really does look the business when you see it. I mean, in the programme, it's just being done in buckets. But when she's doing this normally, there's a big tank of water and it kind of cascades down through this sort of series of buckets and all attached to a pump. It's all very complicated. It's sort of like Time Team meets Ground Force with some sort of Charlie Dimmock water feature.
It is, isn't it? And the thing is, it looks a bit homemade too, and she has to be able to pack it all down to get it in her van, which really adds to the kind of quirky nature of it. But it's really invaluable on site, as you've been finding out.
This is a magnificent machine. It's like a waterfall, like a cascade. You've got a huge pool at the top, probably about, I don't know, a metre by a metre, and then it cascades down from bucket to bucket, like a waterfall.
Hello, I'm Naomi Supal. I'm Time Team's environmental archaeologist, and this is my flotation tank. We take soil samples from different features, different things that we excavate. I pour the soil in, I manually manipulate it. The silt kind of goes through my mesh here that I've got. What's left are all the sort of rocks and things that you find in soil, and also potentially artifacts. And then anything in the sample that floats, so for example, charcoal, carbonized grain, mollusks, these are things that float, come up and over into this sieve. Everything gets dried out and identified under a microscope. And if we get mollusks and grains and charcoal, we can tell all kinds of things about what's happening, not just what people were eating, but we can understand crop processing strategies. We can get an idea about different climates. I usually get some pretty cracking results. There's not been a program yet that I've not come up with something good. I shouldn't have said that, should I? The buckets that you can see underneath, so they're my sump buckets. So they allow the finer sedimentation to fall to the bottom. The pump actually recycles the water around. So that's actually what's happening, and that's why we've got this cascading system.
So what does this process allow you to discern that maybe you wouldn't have got had you not got this equipment?
It's all about the finer detail, really, because things like carbonized grain and charcoal, like if I open another one of these, in fact, I may get a bag. Okay. So if you can see inside of that, that just looks like a bag of brown sand.
Yeah, it's a bag of dirt.
There's no way of knowing what's in that, but as soon as it hits the water, anything that floats, like charcoal, is immediately apparent. And a lot of the time people say, oh, we only sample the dark areas because that's where the good stuff is. It's not necessarily the case. I have had so many samples where you've got really light brown soil or yellow soil, you know, almost looks like beach sand. No black bits, no nothing, and it's hit the water and bang. So much stuff has come up and out of it, and that's why flotation is important.
Now, at what point in your journey into archaeology, Martin, did you realise that a flotation tank was not one of those pods full of warm, salty water that people get into and float for a bit of relaxation?
Well, to be honest, Naomi did tell me about those types of flotation tanks when I was there seeing it. And to be honest, that was the first time I'd heard of those as well.
Oh.
So there's a whole world of flotation away from archaeology that I think I maybe need to discover.
You never know, yes. But I think what we've just heard there is a really good example of what I call the Time Team effect. It's really that people on a normal commercial or research site, they only look at what they think might produce results. But on a Time Team, we're doing things slightly differently. We get the tank and Naomi there anyway, every single site, because she's part of the team. And if there's nothing promising, she has a go at something unpromising. And that's when we make those surprising discoveries that nobody thought that we'd ever find anything out from.
And it's the team effect, isn't it? It is, as you say, it's having everybody there with their own expertise. It's almost like these discoveries, or some of the discoveries, could happen just by accident because somebody's sort of waiting around bored because they're waiting to film something, or they're waiting for some other thing to happen that they're involved with, and they think, oh, I'll just give it a go.
That's exactly it. That's when our most extraordinary discoveries happen. Our most surprising things come out of that.
Well, as I mentioned, Naomi is going to be joining myself and Lawrence over on Patreon for a post-expedition debrief. So once you've watched the YouTube video on Saturday, and there's loads more for you to explore and understand over at Patreon, patreon.com/timeteamofficial.
It's time for me to answer some of the questions our Patreon supporters have asked now.
Oh, yes. Thank you so much if you've taken the time to do this. We are actually going to be asking a lot more of you in the future because these Q&A sessions are going to be making up a big part of the extra podcast that we're now going to be bringing you in the future because we are weekly, as I mentioned. So do keep them coming in, no matter what your question is, no matter how silly you might think it is. This is safe space. Patreon.com/timeteamofficial is where you need to go, and you just comment on the post that you find about this podcast, and that is how you get your message to us. Let's start with a question from Jakob, who says, how do you as archaeologists feel about large infrastructure projects? This is a really great question. It's sort of a bit of a, it goes beyond archaeology, I think, as well, a little bit here, Helen. A new highway, says Jakob, is being built near my home. And while I understand the necessity of efficient transportation, recognise that related archaeological surveys can yield valuable discoveries, I can't shake the feeling of loss. The landscape shaped and used by people for centuries is being permanently altered. Do you see these projects primarily as opportunities for discovery, or do you also feel a sense of unease over what might be lost forever? And I'm just thinking, there's some big infrastructure projects that have been happening in the UK recently, Jakob. There's been the Crossrail project in London, and there's HS2, which is a high-speed rail line that they're building between London and Birmingham. And they've been doing lots of archaeology, and you read quite a lot, especially at that London one, the Crossrail project, where they discovered so many amazing things, archaeologists did, as they were digging those tunnels. And I think, well, wow, they would never have been found if it weren't for them having to dig that and make that infrastructure project. But then at the same time, inevitably, when you are building these new things, you are destroying landscape.
Yeah, you're right. It is really tricky. And Crossrail is a kind of simpler one because the London landscape, we're so used to that changing and changing and changing and changing all the time. And also Crossrail is largely underneath. It produced some kind of big building sites while it was going on, but those have now largely gone and been replaced with what was there before. So it's all underground. But HS2 is a really difficult one because I quite often drive weaving out of the course of it because it's coming up from London to Birmingham and I'm going from Suffolk to the West Country. And the scars on the landscape are vast. I've also got one near me, which is the A14, which is constantly being made bigger and bigger and bigger. But we hear so much about the amazing discoveries like Stoke Mandeville Church and like all the Anglo-Saxon settlements that are coming up along the A14 that you would never, ever have got from anything else. I find that while it's being done, I'm absolutely full of the excitement of discovery. It's only when you travel along the road or along the railway after it's been built that you think to yourself, hang on a minute, this used to be somewhere that I went for a walk, or this used to be somewhere that we stopped for a picnic, and you think, oh, that really is awful. But I think the dividend, if they're designed really well, and Crossrail and HS2 were designed specifically to get the best archaeology as well as the best everything else, then what you get, the benefit is so great. Then you look at something like the M5 or the M6 or the M1 and you think, well, that's destroyed the landscape and we didn't find very much because they weren't specifically designed and mitigated in the way that has allowed us to learn so much from the modern ones. So it is a difficult one, but I think on the whole, if we can get really good archaeology out of them, it is on balance probably worth it in terms of the balance of archaeology. Whether or not it's worth it in terms of being able to get to A to B quicker, well, that's a whole other story.
Yeah, well, that is another story, isn't it? But if you're going to build these infrastructure projects, they are, by their very nature, going to be destructive. I suppose it's about whether the companies and the planners who put together the idea of where they're going to dig and what they're going to dig. If they can have archaeology in their mind when they're doing it, then maybe it could, you know, the best can come out of a destructive process.
Which they do have to do. They have to have it in their mind by law. That's part of planning law, that it must be mitigated. And archaeologists can work with everybody else concerned to make sure that instead of, say, it fringes on a cemetery, which you can only really understand in its entirety, they make sure that the whole thing is excavated, not just that tiny bit that's going to be physically destroyed. So good can come out of it.
Absolutely. Great question, Jakob. And I don't know where you're based, whether you're in the UK or abroad, but of course, this is a question that is on the minds of, you know, people all over the world, isn't it? Because there are these infrastructure projects happening everywhere, and some of them can be more destructive than others. Moving on, final question here from Colin, who says, how do you answer someone? This is another great philosophical question. How do you answer someone who calls archaeologists grave robbers? And Colin's saying, I see it in the comments in just about every news story of an excavation with human remains, someone calling the archaeologists grave robbers. And Colin adds, if someone finds me interesting enough to dig up in 100 years, go for it. I suppose it's the amount of time that's passed, isn't it? Because you are handling human remains, and that was a person, regardless of whether it's 50 years ago or 2,000 years ago. That person had a life and a family. Where do you sit with this, Helen? Because I've spoken to archaeologists, even when they're excavating a skeleton that is thousands of years old, they treat it with such respect and dignity because it is a person.
Well, it's the physical remains of a person. It's the body that they occupied while they were a person. And I really understand what people are saying when they say, well, this person wanted to be laid to rest and their family laid them to rest, and why are you disturbing their rest? But as Colin points out, there are a lot of different views, and not everybody thinks that a person resides in their fleshly envelope, if you want to call it that, in their corporeal body. I don't necessarily feel that I am the same as my body, if you see what I mean. Because everybody has a slightly different view, I think that it really helps to understand that range. So in the 1990s, there was an excavation of a graveyard in advance of development in a village near York. And I had friends who worked on that, and they were finding that people were coming down from the village to watch their great-grandparents being excavated, to kind of say hello to them, almost to have an encounter with a member of their family that they'd never met. But because the whole graveyard had to be removed, they knew the named people, and they could, the village knew that this person was being excavated that week and the other person excavated another week. Now, that's very much better, for example, than, say, doing the development without reverent excavation, or employing a cemetery clearance company, which is a really horrible thing to do. I mean, with, you know, all due respect to cemetery clearance companies, they don't do things in the same way as archaeologists do. Archaeologists are used to imagining and dealing with people from the distant past, and we feel that we have some form of emotional connection with them, even though at the same time we know that they couldn't imagine us, and there are so many parts of their life that we can't imagine. And then other people with different life experiences may not like that idea, but that might be because we're so divorced from death and burial these days. My solution is that I go to the literature, because I'm dealing with early Anglo-Saxons who have left behind some of their ideas in the form of poetry. And when you read Anglo-Saxon poetry, you realise that what they wanted, and so it may have been true of other peoples, prehistoric peoples, what the Anglo-Saxons wanted was to be remembered. And having your mortal remains excavated with reverence and with studied, so that we can get out every single aspect of their lives that we can out of them, that's a form of immortality. I don't like the idea that when I die, my body might be, well, I certainly don't like the idea of being cremated and ground up into dust and scattered to the four winds. I feel that's taking my last place that I inhabited and destroying it. I would like to feel that if I'm buried, I'd love to be excavated. I'd love to have that A, that other kind of weird afterlife, but B, you're helping people understand things so that if I've got any interesting diseases or anything like that, I'd quite like to have them written on a coffin plate, you know, how many children I've had, what my job was, so that they can see whether whether I've got weaver's bottom or housemaid's knee.
Sorry.
I'd like to help.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of quotes of what you just said that I think when read back to you, you may regret.
But
I know exactly what you mean. I don't think I will probably end up getting buried, I can imagine. I think I probably will end up getting cremated. But I do like the idea of my body. This is getting very deep, isn't it? I like the idea of my body going to help further understanding as well. Whether that's, I don't know, whether I can donate it to medical science or something like that. So it's a sort of a similar thing, isn't it? We were talking about the ancient Egyptians earlier, weren't we? And how the pharaohs are laid to rest in these tombs, which preserve them for a very long time. And you might think, well, was that them thinking that they're going to be laid to rest forever and ever? But actually, their immortality, if you think about some of these pharaohs that have been discovered and what we know about them now, they are so probably more known by more people in death than they ever were when they were alive. And that's because of archaeology.
Yes, if what Tutankhamun wanted was immortality, then he's got that kind of immortality. And although we don't know the names of most people that are excavated, they do kind of live again. We are fairly sure, aren't we, that Egyptian pharaohs were trying to equip themselves for an afterlife. And that's one thing that we're pretty sure that Anglo-Saxons weren't. They don't seem to have had any concept of an afterlife. And with Christian burial, it's all quite complicated because we know that there is theoretical beliefs in the resurrection of the body, as in the creed. So the idea is that you're buried with your head to the west so that when the last trump sounds, so to speak, you sit up and you're facing the second coming from the east. And the priest is buried the other way around so that when he sits up at the last day of the last judgment, he's facing his flock. And that all works very well theoretically for the first layer of medieval burials in a churchyard. And then when they've kind of got to the end of their space and perhaps they've forgotten who was buried at the other corner, they put graves in on top of other graves, and they know that they're disturbing old graves, and they know that these people that they're disturbing won't be able to have a resurrection of the body unless they go around quite complicatedly gathering up their own bones, you know, a toe bone here, a finger bone there. So medieval people, just like us, are quite capable of believing in two contradictory things at the same time. And so to try to make everything perfectly right to fit the beliefs of the people at the time, even if we could know them perfectly, their beliefs are not, like, just like ours, not terribly coherent.
Goodness, who'd have thought that our conversation would get so sort of deep and philosophical? And that is all thanks to you asking questions on Patreon. Thank you so, so much for that. And that is it for the questions for this episode. If, though, there is something that you've always wanted to know about archaeology, or you have a philosophical question about the future of life and your soul and all of that, or maybe just time team, you want to know how we filled some episodes, anything like that, get yourself on Patreon, join our community there. Head to patreon.com/timeteamofficial.
And we'll be back next week.
Next week, yes.
Yes, come we will, on. Absolutely. Next week, there is so much from the world of archaeology to unearth, and we're so pleased that you're along for the ride.
We are indeed, yeah. We're going to speak to you next time on the Time Team Podcast.